The exile is over. The Babylonian captivity has ended. Cyrus of Persia has conquered Babylon and set the exiles free. Some of the children of Israel have returned to their homeland, but not all is well. Things aren't what they were before. Things have changed. In fact, the Promised Land has become a kind of wilderness. And so the returning exiles are in crisis. Richard Ward describes the scene. Their homeland has become a landscape of disaster, a wilderness of a different kind. It's not a wilderness where bushes burn with word from God, where manna falls, or where a rock yields up life-giving water. It is rather a landscape littered with the ruins of war. What is to keep them from being swept away completely from the face of the earth the next time the eyes of empire notice their plight? They are looking for assurance that God has not abandoned them. And so the exile had ended. Israel's captivity was concluded. But in some ways, the crisis was just beginning. And if one examines Israel's subsequent history, the crisis was ongoing. Experiences of exile always leave lasting scars and persistent doubts and grave uncertainties. I think of such scars, doubts, and uncertainties as symptoms of a kind of spiritual post-traumatic stress disorder. A few years ago, at this time of year, Tom Anderson died after a hard battle with cancer. Tom was my age, a decorated Vietnam veteran who had served 5 back-to-back tours in that conflict. He was wounded multiple times and had the Purple Hearts to prove it. Tom had been homeless for a while, though he was in better circumstances and in Section 8 housing toward the end of his life. But he was still gruff, hard-edged, angry. Outside, I often saw in my dealings with him trying to provide counsel, support, help across the years. He could also be tender and gracious and kind. During Holy Week, the year before he died, Tom called to see if I might be able to help him get some food for his wife and him for Easter. And I told him I would get him a gift card from a local grocer. I wished him a happy Easter. He thanked me, and we said goodbye. And then just a short while later, he called back just to check to make sure that Marla and I had a place to eat our Easter meal, invited us to have Easter dinner with them. He was that kind of guy. But Tom suffered mightily from post-traumatic stress, as do many veterans who have seen the horrific side of war. It crippled him emotionally. Tom helped me to understand that long after the actual trauma had passed, the effects raged on for veterans, for their families, for some way for the whole society. It takes generations to restore balance and a sense of well-being and shalom. Long after his exile was over, Tom was still experiencing exile. He was not alone. A pastor friend of mine, David Lewicki, who used to be one of the pastors up the street at Marble Collegiate, has given a good bit of thought to experiences of exile. And he's come to think about exile as part of the American experience. In one sense, he said, one can read the American narrative as a story of steady ascendance, a land of promise that keeps on fulfilling the promise. We've been progressive inhabitants of the land for centuries now, and to be sure, that's a part of the character of our narrative. But there's a counter-narrative, well, at least one, two, maybe more, but one that has been more on the surface of our consciousness the last few years with the release of films like Django Unchained and 12 years a slave. It's been part of our public discourse in recent years because of what happened to Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice and Freddie Gray and Sandra Bland. David Lewicki argues that America's period of exile was the period of slavery from 1619 to 1863, and the 100 years of Jim Crow that followed that exile from God's plan for shalom. He says, as the exile is the defining event that shapes the Old Testament, the enslavement and subjugation of Black Americans is the defining event in our nation's story. Its shadow looms over everything we do. The shape of our economy has its roots in slavery. The contours of our cities and communities were formed by slavery. Our history and politics were birthed by slavery. There's no adequate vision of life in America today without a reckoning with slavery's effects, just as there is no picture of God's covenant people that doesn't address the traumas and dislocations of the exile. Now, the analogy is not easy or simple. While America is surely an empire, it is too facile to call all white Americans Babylonians or all Black Americans Israelite exiles. In exile, there were layers of experience, even and especially among the exiled. Some were displaced to Babylon, while many others were left behind to starve on the land. Some said life was better in Babylon, and not all the displaced chose to return. Those that did so didn't experience the ruins of Jerusalem as shalom. But just because the analogy isn't neat doesn't mean it doesn't fit. Slavery is the defining reality of our national culture, and all of us have a position in relationship to it, a particular relationship, one that is dependent upon our racial makeup, our family history, what part of the country, what part of town we live in, our religious identification, our circle of friends, our neighbors, our personal experiences with ephemeral realities like freedom or opportunity or agency. Establishing a personal relationship to slavery takes time, and so no small amount of soul-searching to work it out. And what is more, it's not just individual work, but work that involves listening to the stories of others whose positions are different from our own. If David is onto something, and I do believe he is, if more than 240 years of slavery and the subsequent 100 years of Jim Crow framed the trauma that divided us and was our American exile, then the thought that in the last 55 years or so we have been able to transcend that exile and transform our society into a post-racial culture is truly ludicrous. The effects of exile last long beyond the exile itself, just as the effects of war last long after the warfare is ended. Says my friend David, when abolition came, it did not bring what any person of conscience could call freedom. An array of policies rose up to keep Black Americans down. There was lynching and intimidation, violence in the North as well as the South, but there was much more. Federal housing policy downgraded home values in Black neighborhoods, what we call redlining, enforced restrictive covenants that prevented Blacks from moving up, and radically limited lending opportunities and access to affordable credit for Black families. During a period in which most household wealth was vested in real estate, such policies created the white-Black wealth gap we still see. Many of us of a certain age have engaged in deep conversations across racial lines over the years, and we have seen progress, in some cases considerable progress, in breaking down racial divides. But in some clearly visible ways, our nation has slipped backwards, has lost some of the gains that were made. On this weekend, when we honor the memory of Martin Luther King Jr., one of the best ways we can claim his legacy is through recognition that we all have a long way to go to overcome the effects of our exile. That while Dr. King's dream is still alive, for many it is still what Langston Hughes called a dream deferred. Deferred in terms of economic vitality and education, and perhaps most obviously in standing with the criminal justice system. In a compelling opinion piece a few years ago in The Times, Yale professors Jason Stanley and Vesla Weaver proposed that there was a significant gap between our national ideals of liberty and justice for all and the actual experiences of many of our fellow citizens with the criminal justice system. Not much has changed since they wrote that piece. The fairness of a system of justice, they said, is measured by the degree to which its laws are fairly and consistently applied across all citizens. In a fair system, a group is singled out for punishment only insofar as its propensity for unjustified violations of the laws demands. But there's an unfair system, too, one that unfairly applies the laws governing the removal of liberty primarily to citizens of one race, thereby singling out its members as especially unworthy of liberty, which is the coin of human dignity. There's a vast chasm between our democratic political ideals and the experience of many. The philosopher Elizabeth Anderson argues that when political ideals diverge so widely from reality, the ideals themselves may prevent us from seeing the gap. Officially, the laws in the United States that govern when citizens can be sent to prison or questioned by the police are colorblind. But when the official story differs greatly from the reality of practice, the official story becomes a kind of mask that prevents us from perceiving. And it seems clear that the practical reality of the criminal justice system in America is far from colorblind. The traumatic exile is over. The effects of exile, however, can continue for generations. And like the post-traumatic stress that keeps fears and anxieties in the forefront of a war veteran's spirit, such effects can cripple and harm long after the actual warfare ceases. Hopes and dreams of a true return to a promised land are permanently deferred, while the community deals with all that cripples and discourages. Now, our failure to live up to our ideals need not be the final word, of course. Confession of those failures might be a suitable first word. Acknowledgement of the gap between our ideals and the reality on the ground is the beginning point of repentance and turning. Harvard's Stephanie Paulsell says that the servant who speaks in Isaiah is well aware of all the ways in which he personally and the community as a whole have fallen short of the ideals to which he was called. "I have labored in vain," the servant admits. "All the strength God gave me I spent for nothing and vanity." But then the servant remembers God's call. Remembers God's high purposes still breaking through. The servant knows who he is and with whom his loyalties lie. "Surely my cause is with the Lord," the servant sings, "and my reward is with my God." Paulsell says it is the servant's memory of the mighty work of reconciliation to which God has called him that opens a space in which once again the servant can hear God's voice. When God speaks again, God not only renews the servant's original calling, but enlarges its scope. Rather than looking upon the servant's failures and adjusting the call downwards to meet diminished expectations, God says to the servant, "It is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the survivors of Israel. I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. And the servant's own return to God, a larger vocation is given. Shine as a light to the nations, to every person, to every life, so that there is nowhere my salvation does not reach. Surely this is the song that God sings to each of us, that all our work, no matter how local, must have the greater good of the whole world as its aim. In our globalized world, in which a seemingly innocuous action, a purchase, say, in one place, can contribute to suffering in another, this is no easy vocation. Embedded in the call to be a light to the nations is a call to know the world in which we hope to shine. I think we do a pretty good job of such discernment in this community of faith most of the time. But as the prophet Isaiah and Dr. King would surely tell us, there is a gap between the ideals to which we hold and the reality all around us. There is still that gap. And in that gap, I believe, is where we will find our God-given vocations.